Hello and welcome to Under New Management, the podcast that highlights new and notable management research that can enhance your effectiveness as a leader in your organization. I'm Mike Johnson from the Foster School of Business at the University of Washington in Seattle. In this episode, I talk with Stuart Bunderson, who's sitting across the table from me. We talk about a study he recently conducted on seeing work as a calling with a sample of zookeepers. Well, Stuart, welcome to Under New Management. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Great to have you here in Seattle. Well, Stuart, your study looked at what it means to see work as a calling. Can you talk about what that really means, to see work as a calling?
Yeah, sure. So we have begun to see in our field, we've begun to see some people talking about work as a calling. And we see, really, we haven't seen much consensus on exactly what people mean when they say that work is a calling. So what we did in this study is we went back to the origins of the construct of a calling to see kind of where this comes from. And it actually has very deep roots. If you go way back to medieval times, you see that work really was not seen as something that could ever be a source of meaning or anything sublime in any sense. And yet with the Protestant Reformation, you've got people like Martin Luther and John Calvin, who introduced the revolutionary notion that work could be a calling from God, that by making shoes to cover and warm human feet, you were serving God with just as much divine approbation as if you were a monk or a priest. And this is sort of a new notion for people in the Reformation, and it led to an elevation of work that, okay, I'm not just sort of engaged in drudgery as a way to earn my daily bread. I am, by sweeping this street or by making these shoes or by even plowing this field, I'm serving God, because my contribution of this, of these shoes, or of this corn, or of this clean street, is something that makes lives better, and therefore it's a divine, it's an offering, it's a personal offering that I make for the human society, and that's the classical origins of the notion of calling. More recent formulations of the calling construct differ. I think people have assumed that because we live in a society that's much more secular, that the concept of calling is somewhat anachronistic, in that we use the term, but we don't really mean the same thing, and that calling is more about finding your bliss or doing something that you find to be meaningful and a value. And that's kind of, those are some of the more recent formulations. And one of the things that we're doing in this study is saying that actually, at least for the people we looked at, calling looks a lot like it did for those early Protestant reformers.
Interesting. Well, how did you become interested in studying work as a calling?
Well, I was actually interested in the idea of people who work for a cause. Jeff Thompson is a professor at Brigham Young University. He and I were interested in studying people for whom motivations to work are not just financial, and they're not just socio-emotional, but that they're more ideological. I think we're all sort of familiar with the notion that people work for different reasons, but we tend to focus primarily on either financial, economic reasons for working, things like pay and benefits, or we tend to focus on socio-emotional reasons for working, things like esteem and friendship. And those tend to dominate our investigations of the reasons for working and the basis upon which people form their work expectations and their work relationship. Well, it occurred to us that there is a whole class of employees who work for neither reason, that they work because by working they feel that they're contributing to a cause that's bigger than them, and that it's not so much about how much I make or the benefits that I have or even the friends that I'm interacting with. It's about the fact that by working for this organization, I'm contributing to a cause that means a lot to me and that's bigger than me. So that's sort of all background, and it's a long way of answering your question, Mike, but the essentially what we wanted to do was find a place where we could study this. And we looked around and we said, where could we study this issue Where could we find a group of employees who clearly don't work for financial reasons and clearly don't work for socio-emotional reasons, but who probably work for a cause or for an ideology?
Sure. And so that, who did you decide to study?
Yeah, it led to the zoo. That led to the zoo. And actually, the way this happened, I was just listening to, I think it was a radio program once about zoos and how zoos have evolved in recent years from kind of cement and iron bar enclosures to institutions that lead the global battle to preserve biodiversity. And zoos, in fact, are really at the cutting edge now, but they weren't 50 years ago, 40 years ago. They were really places that this is another entertainment option. And you went to for spectacle, and you went to see animals behind bars. They are not that way now. And it fascinated me that they had adopted a very powerful and clear ideology. And so Jeff Thompson and I decided that we would study these. And now let me tell you a little bit about zookeepers, because it'll give you a sense for why I say that it's more likely ideology than economics or these sort of friendship considerations. Zookeepers make, on average, about $26,000 a year. So this is not a highly paid profession.
No.
This is a profession that clearly is a labor of love. Not only that, but it's not a profession where there's a lot of status or esteem associated with a zoo. In fact, zookeepers are doing what sociologists call dirty work. You know, they're cleaning cages. They're picking up manure.
They're literally
dirty work. They spend much of their time doing things that a lot of people would look down on. And one of my favorite stories in that regard is this was told to us by a zookeeper. He said there was a school group that was coming through the zoo, and it was led by a nun, and she was standing there by one of the animal enclosures, and a zookeeper was there cleaning the enclosure. And this nun turned to her school group, and she said, "Now, kids, look, this is the kind of job you get if you don't stay in school."
So nice.
And this is within hearing distance. And the ironic thing about that is that 4 out of 5 zookeepers have a college degree. Huh. So chances are very good that zookeeper had that she was referring to had a college degree, or right, perhaps even more education than she did. So and yet it said that I think that points to the fact that this is a low status occupation. Well, so what we did is we thought, well, okay, let's once we got our arms around how they were thinking about this concept of calling, we thought, well, why don't we measure it and let's see what it predicts. In other words, what behaviors and attitudes seem to be associated with this sense of calling. And so we teamed up with the American Association of Zookeepers. This is an association that represents a good percentage, not all, but many of the zookeepers that work in the zoos and aquaria here in the United States and Canada. And we made a presentation to the executive committee, and we said, this is what we want to do, this is what we want to study, and they partnered with us. And we sent out surveys to all of their members, and then we also, through them, sent out surveys to non-AAZK, American Association of Zookeeper Animal Handlers, and ended up with something like 900 to 1,000 responses from zookeepers. And then we tried to get a sense for, okay, people who score high on this measure of calling, what else do they score high on, and what are they saying, what seems to be related to this?
Okay.
And what we found is that people with a high sense of calling tend to have the sense of moral duty. And that's very consistent with the, again, the classical origins of the calling construct, that if you feel like you're called, then you have a duty to fulfill that calling. Right. And it's not just, I sort of owe it to my employer, or no, you owe it to yourself because of the way you're wired. You owe it to society. You owe it, in this case, to the animals who have been are in captivity through no choice of their own. And this sense of moral duty leads these zookeepers to be willing to make sacrifices that other employees might not make. Mm-hmm. They'll come in the middle of the night if there's a problem with their animals. They'll be out there cleaning cages on a snowy day. They'll take pay that others would turn their nose up at and walk away. So this sense of moral duty has pretty powerful implications for what they do. But calling also leads to a sense of identity. In other words, if I have this sense of calling, if I was born a certain type of person with certain gifts and talents, then, hey, I'm a part of a pretty select fraternity of people who are like me. Mm-hmm. And I have a pretty legitimate claim to membership in that fraternity because we're all kind of similarly weird, I guess you could say. You know, we're all kind of animal people. And so it leads to this strong sense of identification, not with the zoo, but with the profession of zookeeping. Mm. So I am a zookeeper. I'm not an employee of XYZ right. Zoo. I am a zookeeper. And this leads to a strong sense of meaningfulness in the work and in the work that they do. So,
sure.
And in turn, those predicted some other important outcomes, didn't they?
Yeah, so essentially, if you look at what, to date, what scholars have said about calling, they say calling leads to this strong sense of meaning. And we say, yeah, our research strongly supports that by giving zookeepers this sense of identity and identification, it leads to a feeling of connection to a community of practitioners. Mm-hmm. It leads to an ability to invoke the ideologies of that community mm-hmm. to make their own work meaningful. In other words, you can now use what the zookeeping profession says about the work to make your own work meaningful because it sort of becomes available to you. But at the same time, it leads to a willingness to make sacrifices for your work. And another thing that we found that I think speaks to those who are trying to manage people who have a strong sense of calling is that those with a sense of calling were held their organizations to a very high standard. Mm-hmm. They were very vigilant. And they were watching closely to make sure that, in this case, the management didn't do anything that would in any way compromise the welfare of the animals. Mm-hmm. Because I am called to take care of these animals, mm-hmm. and I see it as a moral duty, and therefore I assume that my organization has that same moral duty.
Well, it sounds like having a sense of calling might be good for the individual and perhaps be good for the organization as well. I mean, people have this high sense of commitment to what they do. How can organizations apply your research?
Well, I think you hit it right on the head when you say, well, one thing that organizations can do is understand what a calling means to their employees. If somebody has a sense of calling, then you're absolutely right that they will sacrifice. They will be your star employees in many ways. They'll be the ones who go above and beyond. They'll be the ones who stay late when something needs to be done. They're the ones who come early. They're the ones who lend a hand because they feel it is more than just a job. And therefore, they're willing to go that extra mile and put in that extra effort. So could having employees that have a sense of calling be a good thing for an organization? Well, it certainly could, but let's go back to some of the earlier points we were just discussing, Mike, which remember that if these people have this strong sense of calling, it carries with it a sense of moral duty. Mm-hmm. And that sense of moral duty is transferred to the organization. Right. And therefore, if you have employees who have a strong sense of calling, they're going to hold you to a very high standard. Mm. And if you deviate from that standard, the result will be cynicism. It might even be active
rebellion
or, don't walk sort of blindly into the trap of thinking, I got to get me one of those callings and I want it by Monday, because recognize that if you are successful in hiring or even perhaps fostering a sense of calling among your employees, it comes with costs attached. Mm-hmm. These people are highly committed, admirably committed, and at the same time, they expect you to do the same.
Well, Stuart, can you tell us what is the bottom line for managers then?
I think the bottom line is understand, we've heard some rhetoric out there that you should be winning the battle for the souls of your employees, and calling is one of the constructs that I think is often used when people say this is how to tap into that soul. And what I would say is, once you unleash that power, be aware and beware. And I think that maybe that would be the summary of what we learned.
Well, we've been talking with Stuart Bunderson from the Olin School of Management at Washington University in St. Louis. Stuart, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for downloading Under New Management, a podcast of the Organizational Behavior Division of the Academy of Management. The OB division has over 5,000 members dedicated to the science and practice of organizational behavior. For more information about the OB division, visit www.obweb.org. For more information about the Academy of Management and its over 17,000 members worldwide, visit www.aomonline.org. Computer support for this podcast is provided by Vu Tran.